Hello, Halo fans. Welcome back to the podcast where I talk about everything Halo, from multiplayer to theories to guest personal opinions. Catch it all here. I'm here again today with my good friend Noah. Today we're going to be talking about the Arbiter and the Covenant. How's it going, Noah?
Good to hear you
back again. So today, again, we're going to talk about the Arbiter and the Covenant. We're going to see what we can find out, do some quick history on them to see what we know so far about them, you know, to figure out what happened to them, maybe some logistical information about them, ranks within the Covenant, how they worked prior to the event called the Great Schism, and how they are now, and maybe a possible return we might see in the future. So to start this off, the Covenant, or the Covenant Empire, was a hegemony, which is a hierarchy that's ruled by a social class, and it's made up of multiple alien species that controlled a very large portion of the Milky Way galaxy for thousands of years, and I'm talking, you know, BC time for humanity. And originally, it was a mutual alliance between the San Shayum, or the Prophets, and the Sangheili, or the Elites. And eventually, this covenant expanded to include multiple other races, and their main religion is what they were centered around was, I guess, holding the Forerunners as gods. And eventually they found things like the Halo Array and other Forerunner technology that they worshipped and integrated into their own technology, which we'll touch on here later about just how they decided to go about things that would be different, more of a imitative than innovative type aspect of what they did. And for most of you who've played the Halo games, you know the three prophets, Truth, Regret, and Mercy from Halo 2, who waged the genocidal campaign against humanity until they were defeated in 2552 or 2553, depending on how you look at exactly what point they were defeated, and left over remnant factions, or what they're called now, with new heads of the Covenant, like Jul Umdama, who you see in Spartan Ops, and even in Halo 5, who run he's called the Didact's Hand, and he runs that faction of the Covenant, I guess Remnant is the way to describe. And those are people that you face in Halo 4. But something I kind of want to go into real quick is just the known timeline of the Covenant so far and what we know about them to explain how we got to the point like in Halo 1, 2, and 3, and then see the transition of how we see them in Halo 4 and Halo 5, with them kind of seeming like they're coming to a close, especially with the Arbiter and the events that take place in Halo 5 with the Swords of Sangheili, which again, we'll go into a little bit more later, but then a possible return of maybe not the Covenant, but a Covenant-like faction that we will see again in Halo Infinite. So starting the timeline, in about 2200 BCE, in our reference time for the Halo universe, the San Shayum, or Prophet Schism, begins. And what this is was a internal conflict for the Prophets when the Prophets found a Forerunner Dreadnought, similar to the one that you see in Halo 2 in the center of High Charity. They were kind of, they fell into two classes, where they were a Stoic or Reformist class, groups. And they conflicted on whether to enter the Dreadnought that landed on their homeworld, or to leave it alone. And I guess during this civil war that took place, the Reformists emerged victorious, and they wished to use the Dreadnought and the technology to advance the San Shayum or Prophet technology, which kind of begins the start of the Covenant and how they incorporate things instead of taking over and implying leaving their own to conform to. They kind of integrate what comes in. So after this internal conflict and the civil war, the Prophets or San Shayum actually meet the Sangheili, which was known in the War of Beginnings. And this is pretty much the war between the San Shayum, the Prophets, and the Sangheili. And while the Sangheili, or the Elites, were much better fighters, the San Shayum, because of the Reformist victory back on the Prophets' homeworld, had much better technology. And this ushered in what was called the First Age of Conflict, where the Covenant was just starting, the history of the Covenant was just starting to form. And, eventually, during around 876 BCE, the Sangheili Elites began actually using the technology against most of their tradition. The Elites are a very traditional culture and did not want to use the technology, the Forerunner technology that the Prophets were using, and so they actually ended up doing that. just to be able to fend off and I guess compete with the prophets, despite them having a physical advantage. Eventually, wrapping up the Sanshayum War and the first stage of conflict in 852 BCE, the war between them ends, and what's known as the Writ of Union is ushered in. And the Writ of Union is a founding charter and an oath of service to the covenant, which is the covenant, I guess as definition implies, is a peace treaty between the reformist Sanshayum, or prophets, and the Sanheili. And what this pretty much was written and drafted to say was that the prophets would be the leaders, the technology leaders, and the ones that interpreted the religion for the covenant, and the elites would be their guards and would be the warriors because of their physical strength and ability. And throughout time, like in 851 BCE, some Sanheili opposed the Writ of Union, and eventually they started coming on to other races, like the Letgolo or the Hunters. And throughout time, all the way up to about 2524 in human time, many races were incorporated, they were taken over, and many rebellions had actually come about through these races that they incorporated. And in 2524, there's the first contact with humanity, which was on the planet Harvest. And from there, we're pretty much going to go into one of the real first subjects I want to talk about was there are many races and other things that come into the Covenant, but one of the most important roles in the Covenant to help against these rebellions that would come up was the Arbiter. And so with Noah here, I'm going to ask you, who is the Arbiter and why is he important to the Covenant?
Yeah, so the Arbiter was one of those roles that was... It originated with the Sanheili, if I recall correctly.
Mm-hmm.
But it was twisted into something different by the prophets to be more of a mark of shame. So the Sanshayum, the prophets, would use their Arbiter to undergo, you know, suicide missions. They weren't expected to survive. These were Sanheili that were thought to be rebellious. So it was just a way of dealing with heretics. And we see at least two Arbiters within the games, but we I was going to talk about the how we've also seen one Arbiter within Halo Legends
as well. So to add on to what you're talking about, the three of the Arbiters that you've seen, there is currently throughout the Ages of the Covenant, there are 19 Arbiters. And the two that we mostly seen are Thelvadam, which is the Arbiter from Halo 2, Halo 3, and from there on in the timeline. But there is another Arbiter that was before that that's seen in Halo Wars. His name is Ripa Morami. And he was the 17th Arbiter, which means that there was a Arbiter in between them that was somewhat not known yet. There's really no information on him. But he was an Arbiter that had troubled past. And because the rank of Arbiter had been taken down from its original Sanheili title, which with the Sanheili, originally it was pretty much the master, the warrior master of the entire race. And this held until the one Arbiter challenged the words of the prophets. And that's what you were saying in Halo Legends that we see. That Arbiter challenged the words of the prophets and lost. And so the title then became a mark of shame. And it was quickly brought in for individuals like Ripa Morami who had trouble past, and the prophets were able to, rather than waste what they saw was a valuable resource, they could then manipulate him as their right hand and their will to represent them wherever they wanted to go. And they, like you were saying, they would do suicidal missions as described in Halo 2 and Halo 3, where they didn't expect to come back. And many of the times their roles being, you know, suicidal, there was something known as the Mausoleum of the Arbiter, which again we see in Halo 2, where Thelvadam, the Arbiter that we know from Halo 2 and 3, comes in, and even then it is still a religious role and holds some form of value for especially Thel, who had everything stripped from him from being blamed for the destruction of Halo 2 or the original Halo ring Installation 04, and brought in about with Installation. Or Installation 00 and the battles that went on there. But prior to that, the rank was somewhat returned as it came back. And funny enough, Thelvadam, the Arbiter that we know, ends up becoming the Arbiter, again, for the Sanheili, and it forms the Swords of Sanhelios, which is actually an ancient group that was all the way back from the original Arbiter, and he was kind of a tyrannical one, and eventually he was overthrown by the Swords of Sanghelios so that the Sangheili homeworld and it could come back, or at least the continent that was there could come back to the way that it was. And if there was anything else, Noah, please add on from here. You know, anything more that you could think about with the Arbiter and how he plays a good role?
Yeah, I think it's good to note how you mentioned how with Thel, the Sangheili are sort of reclaiming that title as what it was meant to be, which is a title, a badge of honor, instead of what it was previously. And then I think it's also important to note that all of the Arbiters we've seen have been phenomenal warriors or strategists or just leaders in Thel's case, you know, with Rupa, I believe it was, in Halo Wars.
Oh, yeah, Rupa Morbi. Yeah, he's definitely he's huge compared to regular elites. They even say it. Sergeant Forge says it, a massive elite. Mm-hmm. So he's he's definitely like that.
Yeah, he's a
presence. So were there any other, were there any other questions, I guess, that we should talk about, I guess, via Covenant-wise, that would kind of help with sort of the understanding for just people who don't, I guess, understand how the Covenant work?
Yeah, I guess we could touch on how, you know, their logistical structure is and why we never really saw an attempt to convert humanity into the Covenant.
Okay, so, yeah, definitely. I actually did a video a little bit back with, you know, the possible Covenant returns, a theory video that I released about a week or two ago, that talks about some of the logistics of the Covenant. As you see, the Covenant, what I mentioned early in the video, is a hierarchy. It follows a social hegemony, which is where a social class rules over the rest of the classes, and that's how they, I guess, are categorized. The Ungoi, or Grunts, and Drones, and many other races are kind of filling out the bottom, and in those, I guess, those social classes, you also have three other classes, which are the warrior class, the religious class, and the worker class. And those fill in the roles as their definition, and as I mentioned in the video, kind of bring in. They fill in for the warriors, you know, for combat as needed. The religious ones follow through, and there are titles given to them that actually, if you read the book The Flood, Halo, there is a grunt who is given a higher, I believe it's the title of deacon. And it's a religious title that's somewhat given to a grunt, one of the higher ones that can be given. And despite him being a warrior, he still has a religious title. But one of the most important that isn't really touched on is the worker class. Now, the worker class, as you, again, we're going to reference High Charity, is huge. I mean, while you don't see a lot of it, in the extended lore, there is a huge amount of worker class that is needed to keep the Covenant working logistically. And even in the book, The Cole Protocol, some of the warrior class jackals or Kigyar act more like the working class because they are forced to do that. I guess the lower down socially in social class you are, the worse off things are definitely for you for the Covenant. And many of the races that sit at the top, like the San Shayum or the elites, you don't really see a lot of them in the worker class. They're a lot more in the warrior class or the religious class. And so that will bring me over to the next point where would humanity fall in for that? But as we know, humanity was never incorporated into the Covenant. And for that, I'm going to talk a little bit about the book Contact Harvest. Now, Contact Harvest, as it was mentioned a little bit earlier, depicts the events of the initial contact of the Covenant and humanity, where the Covenant, prior to the three hierarchs that we know from the games, Truth, Regret, and Mercy, actually has some of its forces, which are brutes or Jor-El-Hanai, use a device that's called a luminary. And what this luminary does, and it's on a Covenant ship, is it helps find Forerunner technology on worlds. And when this Jor-El-Hanai ship and this Jackal ship, or this Kigyar ship, find the human world of Harvest, the entire world is lighting up. And they believe that by finding this, that they will be promoted, that they will be given gifts, and that they will be rewarded highly for what they are doing. And so, as a result, you know, they go to actually meet with humanity, knowing that maybe at some point humanity will be incorporated into the Covenant, but are more interested in getting the artifacts that they believe are there. Come to find out, and if you haven't read the book, I would skip a few minutes forward in this because it's a really good read. Come to find out, the luminary is actually, how they are interpreting it, is incorrect. And throughout the book, you actually follow two prophets, or San Shayum, who by the end of the book come to be truth and regret with the philologist of the Oracle, which I also mentioned in my video about the Covenant returning, is mercy. And so you get a background of these prophets before they ever become the hierarchs that they are. And what they find out from an oracle that hadn't spoken in over in a millennia is that the luminary that the Jor-El Hanai and that all the Covenant forces are using is actually interpreting the, I guess, the signal that shows the artifacts incorrectly. They believe that that signal originally means reclamation, which would bring the Covenant to what they believe is their end-all, be-all goal, which is their great journey, where they will ascend to a sort of godhood and higher existence, so to speak. But what it actually means, and what the Oracle, who breaks its millennium-year silence, says, is no, this means reclaimer. And in that hides the biggest secret that the Covenant, from there on out, have to hide. Or at least not necessarily the Covenant, but the hierarchy has to hide, which is that humanity is the rightful owner and reclaimer to Forerunner technology. And that's why throughout the Halo series, humanity is able to activate all Forerunner technology so easily. And so Truth, Regret, and Mercy choose to hide this piece of information, knowing the huge disaster it would cause for the Covenant. And that will lead me into the what ends up happening, where Truth, who's kind of a douche, really pulls some really bad moves throughout Halo 2 that you can see, and ends up killing the other two, not necessarily directly, but kind of puts them in positions to be killed throughout the next Halo game, Halo 2, and starts an event called the Great Schism. And Noah, I'm going to leave it over to you for a little bit. What do you think about the Great Schism and the fall of the Covenant? Can you talk about what that is, what it implied, and what it ended up causing for the Covenant?
Yeah, so the Great Schism was something that was, as you were saying, started with the prophets. It's sort of the split between the Sangheili and the Jor-El Hanai. So essentially, the prophets, due to the loss of regret, they blamed Sangheili. And so as such, they removed them as the honor guards. And so that caused a lot of issues between the High Council members of the Sangheili and the prophets as well. So a lot of distrust grew out of that. And we sort of see the tensions arise throughout the events of Halo 2. It's something that's quite crucial to Halo 2's story. It's part of the drama and the side of the Arbiter on here. Mm-hmm. And so we see the events of the Great Schism unfold. It's very important because it's probably the reason that humanity had their chance besides Master Chief, because they were given access to, the Sangheili technology and the Arbiter himself, which was huge in turning the tides of the war. So that's definitely something that's crucial to just Halo's story overall. And it's something that's really interesting to consider, because it gave us so much insight into the Covenant structure, how they work, all of the drama that they've had before. It gave us a lot of great looks at, who Truth really was, what his intentions were, and, it showed you how power-hungry he was. And that's something that's really interesting to consider with the Covenant.
Yeah, and I find that, very huge, as you're saying. Halo 2 isn't the only game where we actually see signs of this. I don't know if you remember, but in Halo 3 ODST, there's a moment when you're walking through on the level Terrari Plaza, where there are a bunch of elites that look murdered on the ground. And Buck actually mentions something to Dare, who Dare works for ONI, or ONI, the Office of Naval Intelligence, and they have a lot of intelligence from the Covenant. And she clearly knows what's going on. That's events of the Great Schism, where, as we see in Halo 2, and funny enough, Halo 3 ODST, which takes place during the same time as parts of Halo 2, that that throughout everything, the Covenant, the Jor-El Hanai are killing the elites. And as you say, it starts this Great Schism, where had it not occurred, I also agree, and many other Halo fans also agree, that humanity would not have existed. It was sort of a overall bad move by Truth, but you could see how power hungry he really is to try to make a move like that, and just what kind of repercussions could have happened. And we see that throughout Halo 3, how close he already become, Now, to imagine him being even closer with the elite still on his side would have just been unimaginable. As we know, the outer colonies were, I guess, totally annihilated within 10 years of first contact. And within the next few decades, the inner colonies were just also just destroyed. And so to kind of reassure on that and to add more of it, I'll ask, what do you think of the current state of the Covenant and the species that make up the Covenant? Because if you do some size comparison, which I'll let you talk about here, there's good reason why we were losing both, in space and on the ground for the Human Covenant War.
Yeah, that's something that never really gets across to you as the player in the Halo games, just because you're playing as another super soldier who's crazy tall already. So these things, their actual scale is something you never really notice. But if you take a look at something like the Halo Outpost Discovery, they had a height chart that you could go compare yourself to. There's a lot of photos out there. It's really interesting to see just how massive these creatures were, because even things like the Ungoy, the Grunts, things you would just consider cannon fodder and jokes in the game, they were almost average human height. And so,
yeah, they came in close.
Yeah.
I wouldn't want to have to face that even as just a regular Marine.
Were always in such massive numbers as well, too. I think the Fall of Reach deals with Master Chief and his blue team taking out just an absurd number of grunts at one point. And just, they had a lot of strength as well, too. They weren't wimpy creatures like they were made out to be. And also the other sort of subservient races, like the Yanmei and the Kigyar, they were also massive as well. They were very intimidating creatures. And that's not even including things like the Hunters themselves, which were absolutely massive. And they could even dwarf the Jarl Hanai, which were some of the tallest enemies in the game at around 7 to 8 feet tall. Yeah, exactly. The Jarl Hanai.
These would just crush you. I mean, we see some of it kind of conveyed in Halo 3, but to really understand how bad it is, these size charts really put it in perspective.
Yeah, it shows you outmatched we were and how humanity just... It really makes the struggle a lot more interesting when you actually understand how crazy these creatures were and just how scary it would be to actually encounter them.
No, I completely see the idea of how bad, which, funny enough, humanity did much better on the ground than it would do in space just due to Covenant technology. And that's actually going to be one of the last things I want to talk about prior to our predictions is, what was Covenant technology actually like? Why were we so outgunned? Why were we so out everything by these guys? I mean, very early on in things like the Fall of Reach animated short and the books and the First Strike, another book and a couple of other. Humanity was always at a technological disadvantage to the Covenant and their technology. So what was that like? And what there was sort of some real intimidating factors that went along with it. And can you expand on that? Can you tell me more about how crazy it would have been to have to fight the Covenant on top of what we just talked about, their size and their strength?
Yeah, so first off, I want to just say that I think the Covenant was probably one of, if not the most overpowered enemy faction in a sci-fi setting, just because their ships were massive. The supercarrier came in at around 30,000 meters long, which dwarfs anything you could see within things like the Mass Effect universe or even Star Wars. The Super Star Destroyer was only, 20,000 meters long? So
yeah, something's much shorter.
Which just...
Even the crazy. Yeah, the UNSC Infinity, which is supposed to be the flagship of the UNSC after the end of the Human Covenant War, it dwarfs that still.
Yep.
So, that's just to add to what you're talking about. It's so crazy how big this stuff was, but please continue. Yeah, and their technology that they used with that, not just their size.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting to consider that. I believe you talked about their imitation strategy, if you want to touch on that some more.
Yeah, the imitation strategy that they used was, as the Covenant, I guess, how they incorporated things. They were a much more of incorporation and imitation rather than innovation and extermination. Now, there were a lot of Asians there, but if you have a dictionary in front of you, what I said made a lot of sense. They didn't decide to take over races or force races in. They would do sort of a political move and sort of a surrounding move politically and powerly to these races that they wanted to incorporate because of the way that the nature of the covenant to begin with. All the way back from the prophets or San Shayum, their whole method of the covenant is to just imitate Forerunner technology, the most advanced technology that they can, and then incorporate it into what they already have. So upon meeting things like humanity, who hadn't expanded much, because as I mentioned in the timeline, the history of the covenant goes way, way farther back. I mean, it goes to 2200 BCE is when the San Shayum or Prophet Schism begins, and the Writ of Union is formed in 852 BCE, which means that they're already a spacefaring group. And so they've had years on years to develop this technology, and they weren't really doing an innovative type. They were doing an imitative type. And so I guess that almost plays to somewhat of an advantage for humanity, because the Covenant could have maybe gone even farther had they not. But needless to say, humanity was still at a huge disadvantage. I mean, as you, again, you watch the Fall of Reach animated short, they kind of do a big, I don't know how to describe it, they kind of really stress the importance of certain things that humanity has, like Mach rounds, which are the magnetic accelerated cannon, which is one of the only things that they can really use against Covenant ships. And if you see in Halo 2, the orbital defense grid that Johnson's talking about while you're in the little tram on the way to receive the awards as Master Chief and Johnson, he talks about the orbital defense grid and the necessity of it was just immense. It was needed. Earth was one of the last, obviously was the last colony that they had. It was not really a colony, it's Earth, but it was the last place that they had. And so they brought in all the forces, and one of their main things that they used was the Mach cannon. Now, the Mach cannon, as I said it was, it's a magnetic accelerated cannon, had to be aligned manually. I mean, this thing was primitive, just like I would say for a lot of human technology. Humans used bullets and projectiles and things like that, and Covenants didn't use that. They had things like shields. They had things like plasma technology, which not only with the technological advantage that offers, but there's almost an intimidation factor that's kind of offered there. If you look at things like plasma burns and what they do to human skin, as well as in Halo Reach, they kind of talk about the plasma damage for technology. The Covenant come in and they just destroy everything. And then to finish it all off, they glass the planet with mining excavation beams. And so, again, their intimidation factor is just huge. And it's easy to see how humanity lost morale throughout the war and why the Spartans were so needed, which, if you guys listen to our last podcast, we talk about Dr. Halsey and the Spartan 2s and things about, you know, was her decision justified and whatnot. And maybe while it wasn't in the beginning, the necessity for the Spartans was absolutely needed for the Human Covenant War, especially the Spartan 2s, because of just the huge, decimation of morale to humanity. And so, and you'll see other things like the Spartan 3s and whatnot come in, where they took a more quantity over quality approach just to get rid of some Covenant bases, just to get rid of some Covenant outposts because of how bad humanity was losing and how formidable of a opponent the Covenant is. And so one of the last things, and I'll leave then, now with knowing that the Great Schism and the end of the Covenant really ended with either the Battle of Installation 00 or a little bit earlier, you would say, kind of with the Great Schism. And now that they're the new Remnant factions, which even in Halo 5 are kind of fading out, as we saw, Julam Dama was murdered assassinated at the beginning of Halo 5 by Sergeant Locke, by Agent Locke. What do we think that, like, are for future predictions that we might see in the Halo universe? Like, will the Covenant ever return? Will we even see something like them in Halo Infinite?
Yeah, I think your previous prediction was something interesting to consider, because now that the Banished exist, it leaves that option available to 343, because before in Halo 5, you pretty much saw the end of the Covenant with the Battle of Sinaion and all of your efforts with the Arbiter, because that was essentially some of the last remnants of the Covenant, because you've dealt so many blows to this faction. You eliminated their leader, Julam Dama, and now most of their forces are destroyed. So the traditional covenant that you think of, I don't know if we could see them return, but if something like Atriox and the Banished, which still have a lot of forces at their command, were to show up, that would be something interesting to consider, as well as their, you know, use of the old art style.
Yeah, no, I really like that, the old art style that's there. And I mean, and that's just an opinionated thing. Don't let anyone take that personally, please. I just really like the look of Halo Wars 2. And in that video that you're referencing, when I was playing Halo Wars 2 again, I saw the old look of the Covenant. And one of the big things they mentioned with Atriox is that the Covenant could never even touch him, even at the height of their power. That's the big line about Atriox. The height of the power, they couldn't contain him, which makes me believe that, dang, you know, the Covenant, maybe not labeled the Covenant, could be coming back. Those races that we're so used to fighting, the Ungoy, the Jackals, the Jarl Hanai, and even some of the Sangheili, are all going to come back, and we will fight them just like how we did in Halo 1, 2, and 3, and they will also look the same. Which for me is like, you know, yeah, it's a very nostalgic thing to have come back, but in a different way. You know, they're not necessarily the same color, but they look extremely close to the same, and I can respect where they're coming from. They didn't just kind of, I would say, necessarily appear out of thin air. There has been ways that Atriox has been woven into Covenant history, if you look deep in the lore. And I really enjoy that he's kind of always been there hiding in the background, but to see him brought into light now is just, it's awesome. And to see that possibly we could face the Covenant again, but now known as the Banished as a faction in Halo Infinite, would be absolutely amazing. And so I'll let you have the last few words here. Just tell me what you think about that and what we can possibly see in Halo Infinite.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. I also want to see if we can see some more of just the Covenant integrated, or the Covenant species, I should say, integrated with the wider world of Halo. Because now that they're the end of the Covenant human war is taken place, you know, it's interesting to think about how humanity and the species of the Covenant will coexist now. We see some of that with the allegiance between the Sangheili and the humanity, but we don't really see some of the other aspects, like how are the Kigyar doing? What about the Ungoy? All of those other species. We know the Jarl Hanai would likely not be friendly just because of the way they are, and their general distaste towards humanity, because they never really split from the original Covenant. And so it's interesting to think about how those factions will come into play. You know, there's still a lot of Sangheili characters out there, like Shipmaster, that could possibly come back in some way. We don't know how they're dealing with Cortana and, you know, the rise of the AI. So that's something that's really interesting to consider going forward. And it's also interesting that some of the expanded lore has touched on, you know, what this post-human Covenant war looks like. The two novels, Smoke and Shadow and Renegades, did a really fantastic job of showing you what the world is like for people that aren't, you know, fighting. It gave you that sense, because you see that Kigyar are serving as merchants in some areas. They're serving as information brokers. Humanity has, or humans and Ungoy and Sangheili all come to them for things. You know, they're setting up shops just like any other species, which is really interesting, and I wonder if we'll see that going forward.
Yeah, like how Halo 5, I would say, kind of depicts the outer colonists and, you know, the insurrectionists, old insurrectionist groups that are now not so friendly with humanity. I mean, one of the big things that I think that we would see is that humanity doesn't really trust a lot of these races, of the Covenant. I mean, they committed genocide against humanity. And even Lord Hood kind of addresses it there at the end of Halo 3. You know, I can't forgive you for what you've done, but, you know, I thank you for standing by his side. It's just, it's really crazy. Humanity was brought to the brink of extinction by some of these races, but to see them being reincorporated now back into just, I would say, everyday life outside of war and in with humanity, it's going to be interesting to see what they do, whether they kind of fall in with Atriox. I'm sure some will, or whether they decide to stay their own group and stay out of this new war with Cortana entirely. As we know, Cortana wants to take over the entire galaxy. Will these races stand up for a new faction to, you know, defeat a greater evil, which they, I guess, they view as Cortana, or are they going to sit back and and stay defeated. And that's something I really like to continue seeing, as you mentioned the two books. And even with Halo Nightfall, there are some races out there that aren't touched on really at all. And to see maybe a new aspect of the entire universe against Cortana in Halo Infinite would be absolutely amazing. And that maybe at some point, just like how the Flood had to work with the Chief and the Arbiter, at one point you had three factions, you know, I guess the elites, the humanity and the Flood all working against the Covenant. Will it be something similar that we might see for Halo Infinite? And I think, yeah, that'll be something good. So yeah, again, I'll let you have one last quick little word if there's anything you want to say, and then we'll wrap it up.
Yeah, you know, because at the end of Halo 5, Cortana makes that general calling to all the species that we've ever encountered, you know. So I think that Halo Infinite will have to touch on that, you know, the greater world, your first steps into a wider world type of thing. So we'll see how that comes into play, because I definitely think we'll be seeing more of each of those species, and I don't think we've seen the last of them. So I really want to see what's the plan here with everything and how they approach Cortana and her threats, you know.
No, I guess I understand. I'm excited for Halo Infinite to come out. I really am. And yeah, you know, 343 has a lot on their plate, but they also have a wide palette to draw from of what they can do with this story. I believe there is room for recovery. So I'm going to thank you again, Noah, for being on the podcast. I enjoy talking about Halo lore with you so much. Your extensive knowledge and everything is amazing. And to be able to have conversations like this, you know, just with podcasts and everything, really, it gives me faith back in the Halo community that we can, it is still here. We are still doing great. And hopefully we can start integrating new individuals in. And for so, sure. Yeah, I just want to say thanks. And hopefully that, you know, you'll want to do another podcast here in the future. Looking to bring in some other individuals as well. Hopefully we'll have a whole cast of individuals that I can speak with and that we can talk to. And maybe there might even be more than just Noah and myself here in the future. But I'll give you one last quick thanks, and we'll wrap this up. Thank you guys so much for listening to this podcast. Please make sure to check them out here in the future. Every Wednesday, I release them at 7 a.m. Pacific Standard Time. And also, I'm going to be doing here in the near future streaming Halo custom games for both U.S. and European time. So if you guys are U.S.-based, feel free to that you'll be able to, I guess, hit those and not have to worry about being, you know, at school or work or anything like that. They'll be in the afternoon, probably on Saturday. And for the European guys, we're probably going to do a Sunday afternoon one or a Sunday evening one for your time. That would probably dial back to around 12 or 1 my time. If the U.S. guys do want to join and you don't have anything else to do on Sunday, please feel free to jump in. Everyone's welcome to do anything. But thank you guys again so much for listening, and we'll see you next time.